Today on Maine Calling, how do we balance fear with hope in the face of climate change? Global temperatures are rising so quickly, and humans have done such damage to the environment that our Earth is doomed. That's been the overriding message when it comes to climate change. So it's no wonder that so many feel despondent about the future of the planet and give up on taking action. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today we'll examine what to do in the face of such dire predictions and find out whether we can still make a difference. We'll talk with a professor who warns that humans are evolving in a way that's bad for our own existence. We'll also hear from a novelist whose book about climate disaster paints a frightening picture, but also a way forward. And climate scientists will explain why they believe there is reason for fear, but greater reason for hope. An Earth Day conversation. Maine Calling is coming right up.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. And by Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. For years, we've heard about the scary impacts of climate change, and we've witnessed the changes in our own forests in the Gulf of Maine and in the severe droughts, floods, and wildfires happening everywhere. As we look ahead on this Earth Day, should we be fearful or hopeful about our climate future? What is the outlook for Maine and for our planet? Joining me to offer some perspective on this, Susie Arnold is Senior Ocean Scientist and Director of the Center for Climate and Community at the Island Institute. She is part of Maine's Climate Council. Tim Waring is Associate Professor of Social Ecological Systems Modeling at the University of Maine. He's with the School of Economics as well as the George Mitchell Center for Sustainability Solutions. And Nick Fuller Guggins is an elementary school teacher in Saco and an author. His recent novel about how humans might survive a climate apocalypse is called The Great Transition. We invite you to join the conversation. How do you feel about what individuals can do to fight climate change? Are you worried that we're doomed, or do you believe it'll all be okay? Email talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Susie, I'll turn to you for this big picture question about whether we ought to be fearful or hopeful about our climate future. And I'm going to start with the fear side of the equation. Maine has seen so many impacts of climate change, even just recently with the record-breaking storms and historic flooding. So what would you describe as some of the more worrisome climate impacts that are affecting us directly here in Maine?
Well, thanks so much for the question, Cindy. And for those who know me, I want to make sure that I stress that I am both fearful and hopeful. So while you're asking me to touch on the impacts, I hope we'll spend a lot of today's conversation talking about the brighter side.
I promise you we'll get to the happier part afterwards. Sure. Go ahead.
So, The climate impacts that are affecting Maine are in our face every day. Obviously, we're seeing warmer temperatures both on land and in the ocean. We're also seeing rising seas here in the Gulf of Maine, which are, at the backdrop of some of those problems caused by the most recent storms. Impacts to ecosystems are very apparent, including impacts to humans, both in terms of like heat stress impacts in agriculture, all the way down to impacts on mental health. So the list really can go on. As you know, the Maine Climate Council is in the process of producing our next scientific assessment on the impacts of climate change on Maine, both ecosystems and the human dimension. And that report will be released probably later this month or early in May.
And surveys of young people today, you mentioned the mental health. Young people today, about half of them are feeling that we're doomed. They're feeling very down about climate change and that our way of life is not sustainable. And they've grown up hearing about a lot of the worst case scenarios for what will happen in the decades to come. So can you just speak to that in terms of, you know, what is it that people are hearing? Is there a certain tipping point that scientists are watching out for that is when you say, wow, we really, you know, have lost this battle?
Yeah, the mental health impacts really cannot be overstated. Dr. Vah, who's the director of Maine CDC, is part of the Maine Climate Council effort. And there's been recent studies that have shown that Maine physicians are seeing the impacts of climate impacting negatively their patients' mental health. So that's definitely a real thing. I know that folks on the call here with me have written books on the topic of climate anxiety, and I've heard recently the term doom scrolling, about scrolling through all the doom and gloom news and how that is discouraged for folks who are suffering from climate anxiety. So I think, you know, what it'd be interesting to talk about with the other panelists, I think, is what does motivate folks to take action to mitigate climate change? Is it fear? Is it more of the hopeful concepts of, you know, social connectedness? What prompts people to really take action?
Yes, we definitely want to get to a lot of that through today's conversation. But I will turn, while we're talking about doom still, Tim, I'm going to turn to you because I know one of the topics you study is evolution, and you recently conducted research to look at evolutionary patterns that affect humans as a whole. So could you describe how your study finds a pretty bad kind of feedback loop that involving evolution and climate change?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Cindy. Yeah, this is the doomiest, gloomiest thing I've ever done. I want to just start by saying what I do is I study when human populations solve collective environmental problems. And one of the major things that I generally find in my work is that, you know, group level patterns of cultural change are really important to understanding just, you know, human society in general. It's not just a bunch of individuals, right? We do special things as groups. And a great example of that to start us off is the Maine lobster industry. You know, before the lobster industry was the way it is today, it was individual fishermen, and there was a lot of competition between them. And so that created a problem. And that led to them getting together in groups and limiting their own lobster take. They're cooperating. They're setting up rules to make lobster harvest fair and sustainable. And what we see in there is that they protect the resource and that competition between groups has been really important, competition and learning between groups. So I did this study that you were referring to, Cindy. And this is on the long-term evolution of the human ecological niche, which is the way in which humans interact with the environment. And what we found is kind of a really big problem. It's bigger than climate change, but I think it's important for us to understand this kind of problem so that we can try to address it. So it might even be a problem for human survival on the planet. Let's just be clear about that. So we looked at this evolutionary ratchet that you referred to. And this is a feedback between sort of the adaptive capacity of human groups, right? We're really clever animals. And so we figure things out and we find new resources in the environment that allows our groups to grow bigger. And when they grow bigger, then we have more labor to divide around and we solve problems faster. We're basically even more ingenious. And that leads us to finding new resources, which we then exploit to grow bigger. We've been doing this for, you know, close to 2 million years, depending on where you want to start the clock. So there's a challenge, though, that we're facing, which is that global sustainability, like other resources, like lobster resources, requires systems, technical and legal systems, to manage those global resources, like climate change, for example. And the challenge is that we don't have a global group. We don't have a global society per se to enact these rules. Instead, remember, interaction between groups is really important for determining what comes out. We have a world of sub-global groups, nations and corporations that compete, and they're solving their own problems. So this is this challenge that sort of is what we call a population structure problem. And it's not just a problem for climate change, but quite possibly a longer-term problem for whether we're able to solve problems that are the scale of the planet, right? And the final piece is that these systems and rules that we need to manage any natural resource, they typically emerge after we develop systems of resource extraction, right? So we figure out how to harvest a forest, and we harvest the forest, and then we face a problem because we've over-harvested it. And only then do we establish systems for sustaining the resource and managing it. So good examples of this are the Clean Water and Clean Air Acts in the early 70s. These came after the pollution of heavy industrialization in the first half of the 20th century. The sulfur rules for smokestack emissions came after the acid rain crisis of the 1990s, et cetera. We see this pattern everywhere. So we're kind of between a rock and a hard place, right? So we need a global group to be able to build these systems to successfully manage the climate, but we don't have one. And we also need other groups to learn from about how to do that. And we certainly don't have any of those. Instead, we have a bunch of smaller groups that are not solving global problems. So this is not just a problem for whether we're solving climate change. And as you note, we're not solving climate change at the global scale right now at all. It's just our progress is not sufficient. We're headed for a very big problem economically, socially, survivability-wise on the planet if we don't change. So it's not just a problem for climate change, though. It's even a bigger problem. It's a problem for human evolution and survival. It's sort of unknown at the scientific level if we can survive on a single planet in the long term. So that's about the gloomiest message I've ever delivered. And there it is.
Well, we will still tease out some of those little glimmers of, you know, what can be done from what you just mentioned. But what you described actually is a good segue to Nick, because Nick, you have written this novel, The Great Transition, that depicts a world where we hit this just massive climate crisis and the human race is at risk. But then at the same time, you have called this a climate utopian novel. So why utopia? And maybe summarize the plot so we get a sense of what happens.
Sure. Yeah, thanks, Cindy. So The Great Transition, yeah, it is I call it a climate crisis utopia, and it's set in the near future, and it depicts humanity rallying together to overcome the worst of the climate crisis. And I call it a best worst case scenario. And we see this story through the eyes of Emmy Vargas, the main character. She's 15 years old, and she's grown up in this post climate crisis utopia. And she is a regular teenager. She loves the oldies, the early 2000s music, Taylor Swift, Beyonce. And she is really sick of her parents talking about how much they sacrificed to save the world during what's called the Great Transition. But then there's this big wave of public assassinations of living climate criminals, and Emmy's mom goes missing, and her dad go searching for her. So it's part thriller, part climate crisis utopia. And also I'll just add for the listeners that a lot of it takes place in Maine, because Emmy's father's originally from Maine. He grew up north of Acadia. So we have some kind of local. Rockport, Belfast is featured. There's a scene at the West Gardner rest stop. So some local interest there. But I wanted to write a hopeful story for a few reasons. One, like the first spark for this novel came in 2018. I was working for Sundog Solar, which is a solar installation company out of Searsport. It's the summer, I was installing solar panels. And I found that I really loved the work. It was really fulfilling, satisfying. I love working outdoors and with my hands. But it just so happened that during this time, it was the first time I'd ever heard of the Green New Deal, because Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez had just won her upset primary. And so it was the first time I'd ever heard of a big plan to turn around the climate crisis. So the Green New Deal, modeled on the New Deal, the government would spend money to hire people to install solar and wind and And, you know, I knew this was a stretch, but I started just fantasizing, like on my drive home from work, I would start imagining like, well, what if this passed and I joined the Solar Corps and spent, you know, 3 to 4 years of my life as part of this army of people trying to save the world. And what an amazing thing that would be able to tell my children and grandchildren someday. And, you know, obviously the Green New Deal didn't pass, but the fiction writer in me just ran with that idea. And I thought about it for about a year or so. And then just the last piece, I think what went into kind of the hopeful utopian part is in part of our fourth grade writing curriculum, one of the writing prompts that I give my students to come up with writing ideas is to think of stories that you wish existed in the world. And theirs will be really heartbreakingly, you know, autobiographical, like I'm going to write a story about a kid who's not bullied on the bus, or a story about, you know, a kid whose parents don't fight. So I just took my own advice and thought, you know, I really want to write a hopeful story of how humanity could rally together. And in the course of writing this book, I can talk about this later, but just came across time after time after time in human history where things were so dark, slavery, feudalism, monarchy. People thought things are never gonna change. And anyone who thinks they can change is kind of idealistic and naive. And in fact, what human history I feel like has shown us is that we are so creative and adaptive and resilient, and that we defy expectations over and over again with a lot of work. And that's what The Great Transition, the book, shows, is that it took a lot of work and sacrifice, but that people were able to overcome the worst of the crisis.
Yeah, I just want to touch on that before we go to a break, because I think what's interesting about your book is that you make it plausible, and I'm assuming you did enough research to do so, that you made it plausible how bad the climate crisis got, so that there's wildfires everywhere and, you know, storm surges and New York City just gone, and all that you depict that is, you know, actually believable. But then also the solution sounds plausible, that there are these core, these military-like groups that form, people serving on the wildfire core or the sea level core, right, to do the work that you described, to get so that the human race can survive. And then they create this kind of idyllic very well-functioning place in Greenland to live. So did you just do a ton of research to make it that sounds like it could happen?
Yes, I did 4 months of research straight before I started writing a word for this book. I was working at the Long Creek. I tutored at Long Creek, the youth prison. And I was working on a smack on a boat, delivering lobster bait to lobstermen, as I was researching this for 4 months in 2019. And just, I read, you know, a book on sea level rise and a book on just every part of the climate crisis to help bring it all together. And then, I mean, this was just, when I came across this, I had to read this fact a few times because I couldn't believe it. So much of the Green New Deal or the Great Transition is based on the New Deal and the World War II mobilization, which at this point is, you know, the New Deal, almost 100 years old. And it is astonishing what we did as a country in a time before GPS or interstate highways or the internet. When FDR signed the Civilian Conservation Corps by executive order to employ, you know, tens of thousands of Americans to build public works, within 3 days, they had their first recruits. Within a couple of weeks, they'd built their first camp in George Washington National Forest. And within 3 months, they had enlisted hundreds of thousands of people across the country. And I just thought to myself, if we could do that in 1933, like surely we can do that. We can do this again. And so it just kind of was a lesson for me in like the power of expanding our sense of imagination and hope and what we need to demand of our elected leaders. And that's the kind of energy that went into the book. Like we did it before, we can do it again. And now we even have more technology at our disposal.
Great. And Tim just typed a note about some other hopeful climate fiction out there. The Ministry for the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson. Robot and Monk by Becky Chambers. Wow, you've got a bunch here. I'm going to read them. How to Avoid a Climate Disaster by Bill Gates. And A Darwinian Survival Guide, Hope for the 21st Century by Dan Brooks. So thanks, Tim, for those additional suggestions.
And those last two are nonfiction.
Okay, nonfiction, right. So fiction and nonfiction. Thank you. And we do need to take a quick break. This is Maine Calling. Let us know whether you're hopeful or fearful about climate change. Call 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. How bad is the outlook for our changing climate? Should we be viewing the future of our planet with fear or with hope? Which approach leads to real action? With me today, Tim Waring, Associate Professor with the University of Maine's Mitchell Center and School of Economics. His areas of focus include cultural evolution and environmental sustainability. Nick Fuller Googins is a teacher and an author. His debut novel is The Great Transition, and it describes how humans try to recreate a habitable world in the wake of climate disaster. And Susie Arnold is with the Island Institute, where she's the senior ocean scientist and director of the Center for Climate and Community. Share your thoughts and questions. Email us at talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. And calling in now is Ivan Fernandez. He's Distinguished Maine Professor with the University of Maine School of Forest Resources and the Climate Change Institute. And he serves on the Maine Climate Council. Thanks for calling, Ivan.
You bet. Nice to be here.
So I know you have been watching the data on climate change for many, many years. Are you concerned about the pace at which climate change and its impacts are happening? Can you just talk about the rate and the trajectory and whether that is a worrisome thing?
Sure. And thanks for the opportunity to call in, Cindy, and for the focus on Earth Day on this really important issue for our Earth. And great to be hearing comments from the panel. All of them I know pretty well. I think the answer to your question, are you fearful or hopeful? My answer is emphatically yes. For a change, someone else was leading up with some of the trends, and we see many of the trends in a climate change, a changing climate system, not only continuing but accelerating. And so that's of great concern. Our system has tipping points in it that are much more unpredictable and far more impactful, that we worry about a lot. And we see climate changing all around us, from mowing our lawn earlier to suffering from allergies more to recovering from the disasters, which we're learning more and more about, to global security that's impacted by instability that climate change brings. But I am hopeful as well, and not just because that's the theme of the show, but because I sincerely think that we have the capacity to improve. And in fact, here in Maine, we're known for our Maine Won't Wait climate action plan. We have solutions going forward, not going backwards. Most of the solutions are early stage and are accelerating, are also increasing. And so I think because we have a plan, we have a pathway for the future, not to the past, that will give us the opportunity to work together to make for a better future. I've been around for a while. I was around for the first Earth Day. And so most of my 50 years since then have been involved with environmental issues, particularly air pollution. And we've seen policy address lead in gasoline that would spread all over the earth, the first forever chemical. We've seen the Montreal Protocol as we came together to address ozone. We've seen the reauthorization of the Clean Air Act in 1990. Give us essentially dramatic improvements in acid rain. So I think we know how to do this if we have a plan going forward. And unfortunately, climate impacts have to be tangible and real and in our backyard for a good portion of the population to move in that direction. But 15 years ago, I was giving talks about whether climate change is real or not, whether things are different. That's not a discussion now. Now the discussion is, what do we do about it? And I think we do have a plan.
Well, thank you for crystallizing that for us. You're basically saying the fear leads to action, which leads to hope. So that's kind of what I think we're talking about today. So thank you. That was Ivan Fernandez. He's a professor of soil science with the University of Maine's Climate Change Institute. And Susie, I know that you've been itching to pick up on what Ivan was just saying in terms of, you know, we're talking about these philosophies. Either you have to frame climate change as dire because it is, and also because, you know, you sort of have to scare people a little bit so that they take action. But at the same time, you don't want people to feel like, well, what's the point? I give up. I can't do anything. So how do you, with the knowledge you have and the emphasis on action that you are also so concerned with, how do you strike that balance between fear and hope?
That's a great question. So Ivan and I are asked a lot to be the doom presenters, to talk about the, just as you asked me at the beginning of the hour, to talk about the impacts of climate change. And there's not a lot of good news when we're keeping tabs on things like warming oceans and rising seas, especially as an ocean scientist. You know, I could run down the list of the negative trends that I could report. But, you know, one thing I wanted to mention is several years ago, there was a conference here in Maine called Gulf of Maine 2050, looking out to what the Gulf of Maine is going to be like in a few decades. And, you know, again, a lot of negative messages about what we're headed for in terms of impacts on fisheries and other things that we really care about. So a lot of hard things to hear. But one of the papers that came out of that conference was around how to be a hope giver in communicating science. And that is something that I've really challenged myself to do over the last few years, is to really, when sharing that bad news and the negative things that we are seeing and we can expect due to climate change, I think it's also very important to pair the solutions to those problems. So as we've discussed, there's a lot of human ingenuity, and there's a lot more technology that we have to bring to bear to solve this problem. And so one of the papers coming out of that Gulf of Maine 2050 conference talked about how to communicate that science and how to do it effectively to prompt people to take action. And that is to include things that that get at people's heads, at their hearts, and at their hands. So what the authors meant by that was you have to improve people's agency and provide them with pathways to take action. So the head part being helping them to understand the impacts of climate change. The heart part is really getting at that agency and efficacy piece. And lastly, the hands part, I think, is the most important one, is to kind of arm them with things that they can do and give them that intention to participate in action to help solve the problems. So being able to provide people with a way to see themselves in the solution, and also to provide them with that image of what the future could look like, so they have that positive thing in their brain that they can kind of look to, is all about an important part of setting personal goals. So Nick, looks like you have a comment to add there. So
yeah, I'll stop now. Go ahead, Nick, and then we'll go to callers. I know we've got so many calls coming in.
Yeah, Susie, I just thought that positive vision for the future is so important, especially because, you know, as a teacher, but anyone who went through the education system here in the U.S. will know that so much of our required reading here in the United States is dystopia. We are trained to expect bad things. If we think about our reading lists, like starting in sixth grade, The Giver by Lois Lowry, Lord of the Flies, 1984, Brave New World, Animal Farm, and all these books teach us as children that the world is bad, and if you try to fix it, it will become even worse, and you'll be left like alone and unloved. And there's a great book called Everyday Utopia by Kristen Godsey, and she really gets into this. And so, what you're mentioning is so important, because without a positive vision of the future, despair is so it's so easy to despair. And so, I just really want to highlight that.
Thank you, Nick. And let's get to the calls now. Victoria is calling from Waldo. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for this conversation. Thank you so much. It's wonderful. And I wanted to talk about the hands part that we were just discussing about how to be a hope giver. And there's a very effective measure called carbon pricing. And I don't hear a lot of conversation about it in anywhere. But it's I was recently in Canada for the eclipse, and they have carbon cashback in Canada. They price carbon, and the dividend from pricing carbon from carbon emissions producers is distributed to the population. They get $736 a year. It comes in real handy. And I wanted to mention that your essay contest, Maine Public had an essay contest for Future mm-hmm. Driver for these stories of kids, of people doing things, the art and essays. And your second place winner was a young person who talked about her advocacy with lawmakers for carbon cashback. And it's a very effective way. The number one way to get to our keep the temperature down goal, stop cooking, is carbon pricing. It's not a silver bullet, but it's part of a silver buckshot approach of other methods as well, electrifying things and having an all-over approach. And the best way to get group action for us so far in this country while we have democracy is to really double down on democracy and personally show up to lawmakers' offices, have nice meetings with them, talk about resiliency, thank them for things that they've done, and press for carbon pricing and carbon cashback for Maine. And people can look at that, carbon cashback, the number 4, ME.com, and that'll give you some solid information there. And again, great. Thank you so much for this conversation. I really appreciate hearing everything that's being said.
Thank you, Victoria, for your call and for your passion there. And Tim, I know something that Victoria just mentioned was this idea of the buckshot, you know, that people, I think, do give up when they say, oh, my little bit of recycling or my little electric car isn't going to do anything on its own. But she raised that collective idea. And so talk about that.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you, Victoria. I think that was a great call. Thanks for mentioning the idea of the carbon rebates, and the version that's happening there in Canada is a really important example. And hopefully we'll pass more of those, because it makes it possible to increase, carbon fees, taxes on, say, fossil fuels. But then you take that money and you just give it directly back to the consumers. So that at the end of the day, most people are not paying more at the pump. You get more back than you have to pay extra at the pump. So it's actually a win for consumers. So that's a really important solution. You know, on the buckshot solution, I love that idea. We need all, anything and everything. We need to put it all in the chamber and we need to fire it. And then we need to fill the chamber again and fire it again. And, you know, all of it is good. But I do want to stress something that Victoria said, and Nick and Susie have also hinted at this, is the importance of group level change, right? The importance of making change at the level of the group, changing laws, changing policies within your organization. That is where the action is. You know, there's, for a long time, the United States in particular is the society that I'm most familiar with, right? It focuses a lot on individual responsibility for environmental problems. And that's a red herring, folks. Yes, you can do good things by changing your individual behavior, but it's a drop in the bucket. And it's also not where the change is. It's not where the real levers are. The real levers are when we get whole groups of us to agree to work differently. You can go your entire life, and of course, many people do, trying to be as environmentally responsible as you can, but you're operating within a system that has certain choices. And unless we change the choices, we can't affect a bigger level of change. So that's I think, an example of a more things we should put in the buckshot chamber. Nick?
Yeah, I was really shocked to learn that the term carbon footprint came about from British Petroleum, from their advertising PR firm. So the idea, as you're saying, that this is an individual problem is actually something that the fossil fuel companies have been hoping we will embrace to take the responsibility off of them, which I couldn't believe that. I found that just so insidious. And I just wanted to add in real quick, because like what Susie had mentioned earlier about hope, and also what Tim, you're saying about working as a group, just to show how easy and empowering it can be. When this novel came out in the summer, I did some book talks, and one person in my town, I live in Biddeford, reached out to me afterwards and said, you know, we should get a local group together. And so we put up some flyers, and now 4 months later, we have, you know, 15, 20 people that meet every other week. And just tomorrow, in honor of Earth Day, we're putting on a climate town hall at the MacArthur Library in Biddeford. Anyone's welcome, 5:30 to 7:30. And we'll be hearing from some speakers, polar scientists, someone from the Citizens Climate Lobby, which advocates for exactly what the caller mentioned about the carbon pricing. And then we're also going to be asking our city council to put a conservation easement on our local park to spare it from single family luxury development. And I feel like that's part of the buckshot. Like, every little thing counts, and anyone can, you can just do it. You can go put up flyers, and other people are concerned. And it was shockingly easy to get a group together. And I think it makes all of us feel hopeful. And now we have a climate action team up and running. And so I just encourage anyone in any town to start one of your own, or there might already be one.
Great. And we do need to go to another break. We'll go to Bonnie right afterwards. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. To mark Earth Day, our conversation is about climate change, how pessimistic or optimistic we ought to be about the pace and severity of our changing climate, and what the future might look like for planet Earth. My guest today, Nick Fuller Googins, is an author. He wrote The Great Transition, and he's an elementary school teacher in Saco. Susie Arnold is an ocean scientist with the Island Institute, and Tim Waring is associate professor at UMaine, focused on cultural evolution and sustainability. Join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. And we will now go to the phones. This is Bonnie calling in from Belgrade. Hi, Bonnie. Go ahead.
Hi, Cindy. Hi. Wow, there's so much to comment on in this discussion. I've heard amazing things in the last 10 minutes about carbon pricing, and I heard Citizens Climate Lobby mentioned, and I'm so glad to hear somebody saying that placing the responsibility for climate change on individuals is a red herring. But one of the main reasons I called today was to tell you about a hopeful educational activity that we did for Earth Day in downtown Waterville yesterday. It was a community art build. Over 65 people of all ages helped create a moving mural that illustrated a story called How Humanity Managed to Save the Planet. And the story was written by one of our Citizens Climate Lobby volunteers, Cynthia Stanchoff. It was super fun for everyone, and we had information at various tables about ways that people could actually help save the planet. The story has already been posted with the moving mural on the Maine Calling website, so I hope a lot of people do take a look at it. I got to say that, you know, events like this are really fun and educational and hopeful. The story has a happy ending for life and the planet. It'll make a great children's book. And these events make us realize we're not alone in our concern about climate change. As a Citizens Climate Lobby volunteer myself, I have asked hundreds of people over the last 5 years, are you concerned about climate change? And 95% of them have said, yes, we need to do something. So it's important to realize that we're not alone in our concern. But, you know, being fun events and being hopeful only takes us so far. And honestly, I think that hope without action is hopeless, honestly. And I think that a good dose of fear is in order. But as I mentioned, I work with an amazing organization called Citizens Climate Lobby, and that's the group that organized the Earth Day event that I was just describing. We have thousands of volunteers all over the country working for fair, realistic, effective climate policy, which is what Victoria was just describing. And we want this policy enacted by the U.S. government. Carbon pricing is in 45 countries all over the world. The U.S. is one of the only developed nations that does not have it. And it is a great policy, as somebody was just explaining how it works in Canada, so that the fees that are collected from a price on carbon are rebated to all U.S. households so that the people who are really, we're not putting it on the backs of the low and middle income people.
Right.
I think that was already sort of described. So, so we need big solutions. And I just want to urge anybody who's concerned about climate change to contact our members of Congress. Collins and King are on the Climate Solutions Caucus. They can do something about this, and they need to hear from us. You will feel better when you take some action, and there is hope.
But thank you, Bonnie.
To contact Collins and King and Golden and Pingree.
Okay. Thanks so much for calling in, Bonnie. Go ahead, Susie.
Thanks, Bonnie. Those are some really great points. You know, I think I wanted to introduce some of the components of what's called the theory of hope. And because you mentioned, you know, hope, kind of equating it to just optimism or wishful thinking. And actually, there's a science of hope. It's in the psychological literature dating back to, you know, over 30 years. It's actually more published scientific literature on the science of hope than there is on something like ocean acidification, it turns out. So it's something that scientists have been measuring for decades now. And really, it is a framework for action. So the science of hope is actually quite actionable. It has to do with goal setting and agency thinking, which is, you know, likened to willpower, and pathways thinking, which is also termed way power. So I just wanted to bring to viewers' attention or listeners' attention that there is social science behind what is called the science of hope, and it's oftentimes called constructive hope in the literature. And it is very much more than just wishful thinking, because it is this framework for taking action.
Thanks for bringing that up, Susie. I also wanted to follow up on this idea that I know that you were saying scientists sort of have collectively started talking more about hope as a messaging thing, right, just to get people to take action. But beyond it being just messaging and kind of using it that way, it seems like there have been some turning points, that there have been successes that are, you know, just not being, I guess maybe people don't hear about those as much, about times in this fight against climate change when it worked, you know. And Tim, you mentioned some before. So was it acid rain, right? And of the other things we used to hear about, the ozone.
Exactly. The ozone is a great example. You know, I think, you know, looking at sort of where are we going to move the needle? Obviously, national level effort is really important. But definitely international effort and cooperation is required. And the good news, right, is, and this is a true reason for hope, is that we have solved a number of environmental collective challenges at the international level before. One that people don't often think about is the international moratorium on whaling, right? Whales are going extinct. It's not great. We haven't solved it all. But we did come together and say, we're going to stop whaling in order to preserve the species, those species. You know, the Montreal Protocol outlawing chlorofluorocarbons is another good example. And that really did slow down the creation of the ozone hole, which has significantly grown back as a result, although it's not a simple thing. We need to hold true to that. I think another good example that is brand new, that is an international example, is the example from the European Union. The policy mechanism called the CBAM, which is the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism. The idea here is it's a carbon tariff, right? And so this is between countries. And so if you want to do business with the EU, you need to either not produce much carbon in the production of your products that you sell to them, or you face a tariff based on the amount of carbon that you've produced. And this is really good because it's a between group ratchet mechanism. And that's where we like to see processes happen to really get change going, because no one wants to pay extra tariffs. And so in order to do business, if the cost of doing business is moving to fossil fuels, that's a good thing. And business is a great place to have those sorts of feedbacks. So I think there's a lot of room for hope there. And we want to align our competition, group level competition, around becoming fossil neutral and eventually negative.
Great. Let's go to another caller now. Jennifer is calling in, I think driving on the road, right, Jennifer?
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
There's three reasons I am not being hopeful. I am not hopeful right now, and I have to put that out there. One is meat production. We got carbon, CO2 that is produced. Meat is very cheap, and people eat a lot of meat. That is a big part of global warming. The second is where all the data is stored in these huge warehouses that are air-conditioned. People think like there's a magic cloud out there, and it's not true. A huge amount of air conditioning needed to keep these warehouses. And the third is, it has to do with construction. People do not realize the amount of heat that is produced from concrete.
Okay, Jennifer, you know what? The reception is pretty bad because you're in the car, but I think we got that. So thank you for calling. And Tim, you wanted to answer. I think the three things that she's concerned about the most are the, you know, meat consumption and all that goes into that, the kind of cooling and the energy use for data centers, and then construction.
And construction and concrete. Those are all really good points. And those are, there's a really nice blueprint, a surprisingly good and concise book written by Bill Gates and his research team, which is called How to Avoid a Climate Disaster. And it's about the solutions we have and the ones that we can build. And he breaks it down by different components of the whole global economy. And that breakdown is very useful. And, you know, we don't have a full solution for how to do concrete in a green way yet, but there are companies working on it and we've made some progress. And you can go down the list in that book. It's a great book. It's a short read and it's very concrete, and it breaks down solution after solution. And it's very clear that we don't have all the solutions yet, but we need some things like to solve how to create concrete without producing extra carbon. And we don't have that yet. And so, yeah, that's reason for action, but it's not reason for inaction. And so that's a recommended book for solutions if you're interested.
Okay. And we now, let's see, we have an email from Jennifer, another Jennifer here. How can we engage the next generation to build hope and agency in the face of climate change? Nick, you work with young people, and I'm wondering what you see among them. What sort of attitudes do you see among the kids? And what can be done to get them on the path to action as well?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, kids love animals and nature, and like there's no work that needs to be done in convincing children to care about the natural world. And so we incorporate into our weather unit effects of climate change. So the kids are aware of what's happening. I sometimes think it would be very strange for me not to mention climate change with 9 and 10 year olds when this is probably going to be the defining feature of their adult lives. It would be doing them a big disservice, I think. So we incorporate in the curriculum, but I'm always very, very conscious to include elements of hope. I love sharing with them what Greta Thunberg does. A lot of them will consider her a hero. Like, oh my God, I can skip school for the climate. Like, this is amazing. What a hero. They love Greta. And I always show them that people around the world, millions and millions of people, are doing everything they can and organizing, and that anyone can be part of this. And in fact, that's the only way it's going to change. It's just regular people. And so they decided to write a collective letter to Senator Collins, who got back to us with a really nice response. So just some early, you know, civic engagement for them at this age. And I know more could be done in middle school and high school, and is.
Susie, go ahead.
I just wanted to add that I think, you know, I've read that one of the single best predictors of hope is our social connectedness. So getting together with people who want to take action to preserve the things that they value. So I know we have youth members as part of the Maine Climate Council, as part of the scientific and technical subcommittee that I'm a co-chair of, and also on all of the Climate Council's working groups. And I believe those youth just today, in honor of Earth Day, launched something called Climate in Me. And this is an opportunity to help engage other youth in the state of Maine to provide them with further opportunities to take action and to help themselves really see a vision of, you know, success and what that might look like and how they can take part in, you know, making that vision a reality.
So for those young people who are feeling despondent or like they just can't do anything, what do you say to them?
I mean, what makes me hopeful, I think, is, you know, what makes a lot of people hopeful is taking action, like we talked about, getting involved in a local community group that is made up of people who have similar values. You know, when you poll people in small rural communities on the coast of Maine to find out what they love about their communities, it's remarkably similar. And a lot of it has to do with natural resources. And so I think that, you know, when I get into a group like that and we're all focused on, you know, a shared goal, and that's what makes me hopeful. And I think the same would go for many youth in the state.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that message. Thank you to all of you for joining us for this Earth Day conversation. Susie Arnold is Senior Ocean Scientist and Director of the Center for Climate and Community at the Island Institute. Tim Waring is Associate Professor at University of Maine. Nick Fuller Guggins is a teacher and author of the novel The Great Transition. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris, and you can find her past shows at mainecalling.org. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about what the legislature did and did not accomplish during the last session. I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.